Let's read Belgic Confession, Article 37 on the Last Judgment. Belgic Confession 37 on the Last Judgment. This is the first paragraph. Finally, we believe, according to the Word of God, when the time appointed by the Lord, which is unknown to all creatures, is come, and the number of the elect complete, that our Lord Jesus Christ will come from heaven, corporally and visibly, as he ascended with great glory and majesty, to declare himself judge of the quick and the dead, burning this old world with fire and flame to cleanse it. Antichrist, category and number. That is the title of tonight's class, and it indicates the subjects that we are going to be covering. Antichrist, category and number. In the last two classes, we addressed two big issues in the 2,000 years of discussion of the Antichrist in the New Testament or Christian Church. The first is this: will the Antichrist be of the tribe of Dan? And that view has been widely held, and you could argue it was the majority position in the first 1,000 years of the Christian Church, though a thing like that's hard to prove, but many of the main thinkers mention that. Then there's a second question: will the Antichrist be of the nation of Israel? And so then we saw that Antichrist would not be of the tribe of Dan, because the texts that they cite don't actually prove it. But maybe if he's not of that particular tribe, he may be of one of the other tribes, so he could be an Israelite and a Jew. But none of the passages appeal to constitutes proof either. The closest to it is John 5, verse 43. Jesus' word, "I am come in my Father's name, and ye receive me not. If another come in his own name, him ye will receive." And let's say we take the last half of that verse and apply it to Antichrist, which would be legitimate. If another come in his own name, him ye will receive. That merely speaks of the acceptance of the Antichrist by the Jews. It doesn't describe his origin as being Jewish. And since Antichrist is going to be received, Revelation 13 says, by the whole world, you could say that to the people in Laos or in Laodicea, or anywhere else in the, you know, you're going to receive him. Tonight we're going to be more positive. That is, we're not going only to be saying what cannot be asserted, a Danite Antichrist or an Israelite Antichrist. You'll be glad to know that we're going to make definite affirmations regarding him. That's a step up, Billy. We're going to consider, in order, the two issues mentioned in the title. We're going to consider Antichrist as to his category, I'll explain that shortly, and as to his number. And when I talk about his number here, I don't mean 666, I mean how many Antichrists. So Antichrist as regards category and number. We are, in these classes, you will have noticed, proceeding carefully. You could say slowly. I prefer to say carefully. We're definitely not going fast, but the key word is careful. What we're doing is removing the rubble, and there's a lot of rubble, there's a lot of rubbish, the wrong views, and we're laying foundations, because you need to have the basics right before you can put a superstructure upon the foundation. Okay, that's my apology. That is explanation. In what category, then, is the Antichrist to be placed? And by that I mean, what type or sort of thing or person is the Antichrist? So this is the first of our two major headings tonight, category. And there are four options here, four options, all of which begin with the letter I, to make it handy for us. Institutional. That is, the Antichrist is institutional, some people hold. The Antichrist refers to a religious institution or a political institution, the Antichrist is, some would say, the UN, which is an institution. Now, what is the most famous view in the Christian church of the Antichrist as institutional, belonging in this category? We've already referred to it several times in these classes. Rome. So the most famous view of the Antichrist as institutional is the Roman papacy, the office of the pontiff over many centuries. This view was held by, as we've seen, the reformers and people for 500 years before the reformers. So you're back to like slightly before the year 1000 for our earliest known reference, and even people in the 500 years after the reformers, including today. So the Antichrist, some people say, that's an institute. It's an institutional thing. Secondly, other people say the Antichrist is impersonal. So there's an institutional view of the Antichrist and an impersonal view of the Antichrist. The Antichrist is a movement, an ideology. Antichrist refers to false religious views. Now, can you think of something that fits this category that was mentioned in previous classes? I think Mary's onto it, Brian.
It's a big word, I can't remember it.
That helps, that advances the discussion. Anybody else, big word or small word, Mary?
Isn't it just a liberal, sort of a liberal church?
Yes, yes. The Roman Catholic Church, in its Catechism of the Catholic Church, 675 to 676, it's a good job it wasn't 666. In an earlier class, we noticed that the Roman Catholic Church says, the current contemporary Roman Catholic Church, that Antichrist refers to a movement. They don't want a personal Antichrist. It's a movement. And various liberal Protestants hold this view too. Now, if you hold that the Antichrist is impersonal, it's a movement, essentially what you're saying is that Antichrist is another category that crops up in the study of eschatology. It also begins with the letter A.
Apostasy.
So then Antichrist collapses into the category of apostasy as an especially bad form or eschatological form of apostasy. And it's interesting that the more apostate the movement or the church, the more likely they are to hold that Antichrist is a movement, a sort of apostasy. The third view is that Antichrist is internal. Antichrist is internal. So whereas the first two views that we've listed on the board have been referred to in different connections already in this class, previous evenings, this one is new to this class. Some of you may have come across it before, but it hasn't been mentioned here before, and it requires some explanation. Antichrist is internal. The first one puts it in an organization, institutional. The other one puts it in a movement or a spirit, impersonal spirit or force. This one puts it inside people. And there is a history to this view. Some of you may have heard of Origen of Alexandria, an Egyptian church father. Alexandria gives it away. He died 254. And according to one scholar of these things, he is the first, quote, he gives the first, quote, fully interiorized reading of Antichrist in Christian history. Antichrist is fully interiorized. Antichrist, then, is false wisdom, or the lie, in the soul. Now, it'll express itself, obviously, in different shapes and forms, but Antichrist is false wisdom, or the lie. And Origen, as some of you may know, was especially big into spiritualistic interpretation and allegorical interpretation. He was looking for deeper meanings of things. So it's not an institution. That's too outward. It's not even a force. It's an internal evil principle. It's lies. It's false wisdom. Tychonius, who was a big influence in the commentary world of the book of Revelation in North Africa, he died at the end of the 4th century. He also held, in part, this interior view of Antichrist. Augustine of Hippo, also in North Africa, this time in Algeria, in his homilies on 1 John, he said that Antichrist refers to heretics and schismatics. That's fairly obvious and correct. But then he says, this is the application of the homily or the sermon, everyone, this is a direct quote from Augustine, everyone must question his own conscience whether he be such. Everyone who's hearing Augustine's sermon, the homily was written down, but was first of all delivered. Everyone in the church in Hippo, are you Antichrist? Everyone, not just believers, not just non-believers, but also believers, are you Antichrist? And then a fourth and final example of this is Gregory the Great in Italy. He was Pope from 590 to 604. His view is summarized like this, quote, Gregory wished every Christian to become attentive to the Antichrist within. I'll read that again, there's more to the quote. But Gregory wished every Christian, not just non-believers, every Christian, to become attentive to the Antichrist within. That is, the elements in his or her life, especially, and then these two sins are mentioned, pride and hypocrisy, that constitute us as precursors of Antichrist's body, or members of Antichrist's body. So here Gregory, who was influenced by Augustine, but then practically every churchman was influenced by Augustine in the Middle Ages to some extent, because Augustine was the great source of Western theology in many regards. Gregory here is expanding Augustine's teachings on this point, and he's going into far more detail. And Gregory was into morals, which is a good thing, the Christian living, but Gregory moralized a bit, got moralistic. So he's working with the Antichrist thing, and he says, we really want to say that you could be Antichrist. There's Antichrist in you, believers. Now, I can remember the first time I came across that view that I'm just being explaining here, Antichrist is internal. And I can remember my reaction to it. But before I say anything about it, I'd like to know your reaction to that idea. Antichrist is internal. The application, Antichrist could be in you, Hillary. Sorry, I'm just asking you a question. I'm not making a point.
Thanks for that. Wouldn't make you almost doubt your own salvation?
That's a very interesting point. Make you doubt your salvation. So Hillary Mayer homes in on assurance.
Would it be equivalent to your old man of sin?
Would it be equivalent to your old man of sin? That was the point you were going to make too, Brian. So undoubtedly, whether in Augustine's church in Hippo or in Rome, as Italy decays into savagery after the breakdown of the Roman Empire, the further breakdown of it and the barbarians coming in, undoubtedly some members of the visible church in those days and our own days were or are hypocrites. Some would apostatize. That's always the way. And then many would divide the church or cause trouble. But the child of God, I put to you, shouldn't go around asking this question of himself. Can you think of anywhere in our creedal heritage that would most militate against this? Lord's Day 1. What is thy only comfort in life and death? I belong to my faithful Savior Jesus Christ, who's bought me body and soul. And that was why Hillary's immediately the problem with assurance. We don't think it's a good idea to tell the members of the church. We tell them that you could apostatize, people of God. you've got to fight against sin, but I don't think, I'm presenting this and you can mull this over, that this is a helpful way of dealing with the sins or possible apostasy of members of the church, and it's certainly not a biblical way. I don't know anywhere. Remember the four great passages? Daniel, 2 Thessalonians 2, 1 and 2 John, and the book of Revelation, which says, you know, there's Antichrist in you. You could be a part of Antichrist's body. You could be a precursor of the Antichrist. Instead, we would say to people with regard to these sins, including the two that Gregory most mentioned, pride and hypocrisy. You know, there's the world and the flesh and the devil. The Christian church has always used that handy threesome. And there's no need to add, you know, Antichrist inside you. Now, there is connection between the world and Antichrist, the flesh and Antichrist, because the Antichrist appeals to the flesh and to sin, and the devil and Antichrist. But think of 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. Here, Christians are urged, don't love the world. And then it goes on to speak about lust and pride. Don't love the world. And then it talks, those things, lust and pride, are flesh. So that's how it gets at these sins in believers. And then it says, verse 18, it talks about Antichrist, many Antichrists, and so forth. So that's a safer way to get at it. I think if we were to start preaching, you know, you could be Antichrist and so forth, you would confuse and distress people needlessly. By all means, examine yourself. But I don't think that's the way to go about it. We can appreciate that Augustine, especially, and maybe even to a certain degree Gregory, want to apply this to the people of God, teaching about Antichrist. But there's watch and pray, and there's look out for false prophets, and don't you follow people who appeal to the flesh. But I, for one, am not keen on this idea of the Antichrist within. And while that idea sits there, we may discuss it again at the end, or with a cup of tea afterwards. Our fourth I is individual, and I'll add an S at the end. Antichrist is individual, or Antichrist as individuals. And here we're saying, and this fourth view is, that Antichrist is a concrete person, or persons. We'll keep that open at least for the time being. So an Antichrist is not merely an institution or organization, 1A on the whiteboard. Antichrist is not merely an impersonal spirit of the age, the forces of apostasy or unbelief. An Antichrist is not merely an internal evil or interior sins. Now, let's consider four biblical passages, and I'll put them up here in the right-hand corner of the board so that everyone can easily reflect upon them. Daniel, 2 Thessalonians 2, 1 and 2 John, and Revelation. So let's take these four I's, the ninth letter of the alphabet, on the board here. Which biblical passages would be appealed to for each of these four views in turn? Antichrist as institutional. Where would you go out of these passages? You go to Revelation, because the book of Revelation speaks of Antichrist in connection with a kingdom and Babylon. So that'd be how you would do it for the book of Revelation. Any other ones? Daniel, similar to Revelation. Antichrist and kingdoms. What about Antichrist as impersonal, as a spirit or force Which of the four would you go to here? Because there's one of them that would be more helpful for the people who hold that second position, Antichrist as impersonal. First and Second John. Indeed. Let's turn, first of all, to 1 John 4, verse 3. Every spirit that confesseth not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God. And this is that spirit of Antichrist, whereof ye have heard that it should come, and even now already is it in the world. And there's a similar passage in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 7, which states that the mystery of iniquity doth already work. An impersonal force, the mystery of iniquity. This lawlessness is already working. Lawlessness, sin. What about the internal? Antichrist is internal. Antichrist is false wisdom or lies in everyone, even believers. Heather? You could go to the two texts in 1 John 4, verse 3 that we just cited, and 2 Thessalonians 2, which support the impersonal. And you could stretch them a little bit to the internal. It's harder to find support for that view. Let's say you're going to talk about the Antichrist as an individual. Of these four, you're only allowed to pick one. Which one would you go for? 2 Thessalonians. 2 Thessalonians 2. That's the one that stands out. In the book of Revelation, what would you go for in terms of one word? You're only allowed one word that's used in the book of Revelation. Sorry, I'm not saying this is a dictator. I'm trying to narrow down the questions here.
Babylon.
Babylon, no, beast. Yes, the beast. The book of Daniel. Well, there were various individual types of Antichrist. And in 1 John, we read the passage in chapter 2. 1 John 2 verse 18 says, little children, it is the last time, and as ye have heard that Antichrist, an individual, shall come, even now there are many Antichrists. So you could put it like this: Antichrist is an individual. We're not dealing with an anti-Christian kingdom or an anti-Christian religion, that's institutional, or an anti-Christian spirit, impersonal, or anti-Christianity, impersonal or internal. We're talking about anti-Christ, not anti-Christian this or that, or anti-Christianity, anti-Christ. How do you relate these four? It's not that difficult. I would guess that all of you pretty much were here in your own thinking already, but I'll spell it out. That Antichrist individually heads up or leads anti-Christian, the anti-Christian kingdom or anti-Christian religion. And there you think of the book of Daniel or Revelation, or for anti-Christian religion, you could think 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. To go further, you could say that the anti-Christian spirit or anti-Christianity brings in the Antichrist, and that the Antichrist in turn then promotes anti-Christianity or the anti-Christian spirit. And of those four options, which one do you think would be the best to present the teaching that the anti-Christian spirit or anti-Christianity brings in the Antichrist, and that Antichrist then promotes the anti-Christian spirit or anti-Christianity? Yes, 2 Thessalonians. Let's turn to that passage and read the relevant verses. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 3. The anti-Christian spirit or anti-Christianity brings in the Antichrist. Verse 3 of 2 Thessalonians 2 says, "Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come the falling away, the great apostasy first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition." So first there comes the apostasy, and then that ushers in the Antichrist. And then in verses 9 through 11, the Antichrist now having come, verse 9 says he comes with all power and signs and wonders of the lie. He comes with all deceivableness, unrighteousness of those who perish, the ones who did not receive the love of the truth, they might be saved, and God sends them strong delusion so that they should believe the lie. So the Antichrist is brought in by the anti-Christian spirit and anti-Christianity, and he then promotes the anti-Christian spirit and anti-Christianity. This fourth one then, the right category for anti-Christ, not anti-Christian or anti-Christianity, the right category for Antichrist is category D, individual or individuals. And those other views, institutional Antichrist, impersonal Antichrist, internal Antichrist, not all of them are wrong. They're only wrong if they deny that Antichrist is individual. And Augustine and Gregory, for example, the ones who said that there's an internal aspect to Antichrist that everyone ought to examine himself by, well, I think they went too far down that line. But they believe that there is an individual Antichrist. They were just applying it in that way in their preaching. And I'm going through all this. I want to state that here we need to draw the lines straight and clear. We need to use words normally. We need to preserve biblical distinctions, that it's not being helpful or wise to say, well, the Antichrist is inside you. And basically that was the main and highest teaching of Origen, when that's not the biblical presentation at all. You might be able to apply it in some sense if you guard it carefully. But use words normally, preserve biblical distinctions, and then look at the scriptures to see how the concepts in the same field are to be related. Otherwise, it might sound profound, it might sound different from what everybody else is saying, but yet it's a reason why it's different from what everybody else is saying. It's because it's wrong, it's your own particular hobby horse. On the other hand, once you start confounding and stretching terms and language, well, there's a sense in which it means this. It confuses people. It doesn't help them actually when they read the Bible on their own. And then to introduce ideas like the Antichrist, that's lies and false wisdom. Well, prove that from the Bible. The proper way of speaking is that Antichrist is personal, individual. He uses lies, and so he makes people foolish and turn away from the true wisdom. But to say Antichrist is lies and Antichrist is false wisdom, no. Everyone with us so far? Let's move now from Antichrist as to category. As I say, we're laying the foundations, and these other options, institutional category, impersonal category, internal category, they are out there. This is where other groups, sadly, go astray. Now we come to Antichrist as to number. And here we have three options. And again, these three options aren't arbitrary. They are out there. When you read the literature and when you interact with people, both contemporary people and their works in church history. The first, as to number, indefinite number admittedly, is many. Antichrist as many. And when this group talks about Antichrist as many, they mean many, but not one Antichrist. The many is, for some of them especially, a way to get rid of one Antichrist. Which schools of thought believe that Antichrist is many. If they have to admit that Antichrist refers to concrete people, and for some that's a bit of a question mark, they want to make that concrete people many, not one. Any thoughts as to this one? There are two categories that have been mentioned in this class before, so it's not, this question isn't coming out of nowhere or out of left field, as they say in America.
Well, if you believe that it's the papacy, then you would have many.
Yes.
Because many popes.
The historicists, with the more institutional form, it's many popes over 13 or 11, or how far you go back, centuries now from the year 2024. And then, this school of thought definitely wants to rule out one future Antichrist, the post-millennialists, who are like B.B. Warfield. Antichrist is many. Antichrist is not one. And Antichrist has a very famous, B.B. Warfield has a very famous article on this, Manuel.
I did think of that, but then I thought, didn't they say the Antichrist was like Nero or someone in the past? No?
Yes, there are some who want, if there's a single Antichrist, he's in the past.
Okay. But some of them don't hold, some postmen don't hold any single Antichrist? Any one person who was the Antichrist?
Well, B.B. Warfield, in his article on 1 John 2, verse 18, I'm giving a bit away here, he says that there is no singular Antichrist to come, that is future.
Okay.
So there were many antichrists in John's day, and then there was Nero or whatever particular, because some of the post mills put it back to AD 70, and others like Warfield would go a bit later. So antichrist as many. The other one is antichrist as dual, as two. Not D-U-E-L, but D-U-A-L. I had to think to get my spelling right there. And Julian mentioned this, a slightly different connection, in the last class. Now, who hold that there are basically two antichrists? There are two groups today that hold to two antichrists, although we're stretching the word antichrist just a little. There are some preterists, so post-millennial preterists, who say that 2 Thessalonians 2 deals with a Jewish high priest, and the book of Revelation deals with the Roman emperor, especially Nero. So they have two antichrists. Then, this one is stretching just a little bit, dispensationalists, like J.D. Pentecost, hold two antichrists, in that there's the beast of the sea, he's Antichrist proper, and then there's the beast of the land, Revelation 13. That was the connection which Julian brought it up, and we'll return to that one. So dual. Some preterists and dispensationalists. I'm going to give you some church fathers here who also had a duality in their view of the Antichrist. Hippolytus, or Hippolytus, who was a presbyter in Rome in the first few decades of the 3rd century, he said that the first beast of Revelation 13 is the Roman Empire. And then, after that, would come the second beast, so it's chronological, those two beasts aren't operating at the same time. It's one comes first, then there comes the other one. The second beast of Revelation 13, the beast of comes up out of the land or the earth, that's a Jewish Antichrist. So there's a duality, but it's Antichrist proper is really the second beast. Whereas for most, with those two figures, Antichrist proper would be identified as the first beast. But Hippolytus, he went the other way. Commodian, a Latin poet who flourished about 250 AD, if he did indeed write the work that's attributed to him that deals with Antichrist. He holds the Nero-redivivus view. It keeps cropping up, Billy. Nero sort of coming back from the dead, reinvigorated, and then later will arise a king from the east. Not a king from the north or the south or the west, a king from the east. But it's that second figure that's the Antichrist proper, although the Nero-redivivus, he basically does the Antichrist stuff too. Lactantius, a church father from Tunisia, he died about 325 AD, around about the same time as the Council of Nicaea. He held to two sort of anti-Christian figures. There's a king of the north, and then after him will arise a king from Syria, who's sort of from the east. Although that second figure is sort of more correctly the Antichrist figure. And Martin of Tours, 4th century French father, he also holds a form of the dual Antichrist. There were some medievals who held that there's an Antichrist of the West and an Antichrist of the East. There are some medievals who held an Antichrist of the West and an Antichrist of the East. Who was the Antichrist of the East? A historical figure. Muhammad. Or some Islamic caliph. The Antichrist of the West, he's going to come up in Christendom, and is the Antichrist of the East. That's either Muhammad, or then as time moves on, it's some new caliph. And of course, that's the sort of teaching that's going to help people become more motivated. For instance, if you're trying to whip up support for a crusade. You can use your Antichrist idea for all sorts of practical and even political and military ends. So the Antichrist as many, the Antichrist as dual, and then there is the Antichrist as singular. The Antichrist as singular. This is, I believe, from the evidence I've seen, the majority view through history, the last 2,000 years. And I believe it's the majority view at present, especially because, though I mentioned the dispensationalist view with an individual called Antichrist or Beast and a false prophet, really, they would say one, but there's a duality to it. So now, as with our study of the category to which Antichrist belongs, now we'll consider the various biblical passages that are appealed to as regards the number of Antichrist out of these same four biblical books or chapters. Daniel, 2 Thessalonians 2, 1 and 2 John, and Revelation. What about the many? Where would you go to for Antichrist as many? Not one, not two, but many. 1 John 2, verse 18 is the locus classicus. We'll start, though, with 2 John, verse 7. 2 John, verse 7 states, many deceivers are entered into the world. Think now, 1st century AD. Many deceivers are entered into the world who confess not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh. This is a deceiver and an antichrist. If you take that statement, this is a deceiver and an antichrist, and say, well, that means each of the deceivers is an antichrist. Or even if you take it, this, referring to the many deceivers, this is antichrist, you still end up with many antichrists. And we would agree with that, yeah. But we don't believe that that's to the exclusion of the singularity. Let's go to 1 John 2 then. 1 John 2, verse 22, who is a liar but he that denieth that Jesus is the Christ? He is Antichrist that denieth the Father and the Son. So if you put that together with 2 John 7, although you don't even need the assistance of that verse, if an individual denies that Jesus is the Christ, if he denies the Son, well, he's a liar And he's an antichrist. And then since several people do that, then there are many antichrists. Verse 19, they went out from us, but they were not of us. So here are people who depart from the church, they defect, they apostatize. For if they had been of us, here's the proof, they would no doubt have continued with us, but they went out that they might be made manifest that they were not all of us. And ultimately the point is, they never really were in their heart. And then verse 18, we're back to Warfield's argument. And Warfield was a great theologian, but his article on this is absolutely atrocious. It's just, it really is twisting the scriptures. It's a man who has a desired end that he wants to reach. And reading this, really, your opinion of Warfield just goes down. Little children, it is the last time, and as ye have heard that Antichrist shall come, even now are there many Antichrists, whereby we know that it is the last time. So Warfield says, now there are many Antichrists. That proves it's the last time. And he takes the statement, as ye have heard that Antichrist shall come, was a mistaken statement. As ye have heard, because people were talking nonsense and getting carried away. But I'm going to tell you that's not the case. And you're thinking to yourself, wow, how in all the world did he get that? Well, what he got was, here's my conclusion, and I'm going to turn it around and try and get rid of that passage. This is the same man who wrote another argument, another article, in which the broad road which leads to destruction, and many there be that go in thereat, and a narrow way which leads on to life, and few there be that find it, he ends up saying that that passage has nothing to say with how many people be saved or how many people be lost. And you read the article and you think, that's very, very clever, very smart man. And then you come back to it and you read the verse and you think, he can write whatever he wants, but that is not what the passage is saying. But he's a really, really devout postmillennialist, and he carries it with him into his exegesis of Matthew 7, verses 13 and 14, and 1 John 2, verse 18. So Antichrist, as to number, it's many, not one, definitely not one. And it's not even future, it's all about the past, and when John wrote. So that would be your chief passages if you're going to argue for many. With regard to duality, we've already mentioned it, so this shouldn't be a hard question. What chapter of scripture would you point to if you're trying to argue for duality in the Antichrist concept?
The Revelation with the beasts, the two different...
Yes, the Revelation 13 passage, the beast from the sea and the beast from the land or the earth. There is another one which you might have just detected from some of the references I made earlier to church fathers and duality. There's another one, Daniel. The little horns. The little horns. In chapter 7, there's a little horn. And the little horn comes out of which of the four kingdoms? See if anyone can remember. In Daniel 7, there's a little horn which comes out of which kingdom? The fourth kingdom. So it comes out of Rome in the west. And then there's a little horn in chapter 8 that comes out of the third kingdom, which is Greece. So Rome's in the west, and Greece is in the east, comparatively, with regard to each other. And that's a tricky thing, because if you read that, and you think of some of your own reading the book of Daniel in earlier years, you might have thought it was the same person. But one little horn comes from the fourth kingdom, and another one comes from the third kingdom. And then there's another... In Daniel 11, there's a vile person. There's a vile person. Verse 21 calls on that when he is introduced in that lengthy and very complicated and very important chapter too. A vile person. And the chapter talks about the king of the south, who in the context, the king of the south is based in what country, today's language?
Egypt.
And there's the king of the north, Alec, and where is he based?
Syria.
He's based in Syria. So you've the Ptolemies in Egypt. I usually put them in my mind, P.E., Ptolemies in Egypt, like physical education. And then you have the Seleucids in Syria, S.S. So there's the king of the north, and there's the king of the south. And then they are battling among each other, and then it leads up to this vile person. He's introduced in verse 21, and he continues through the remainder of the chapter. And he's called a king. It doesn't actually call him the king of the north, But with respect to Egypt, he is the king of the north, just calls him a king. And he is Antiochus Epiphanes in Syria. So there's two horns. And then if you want to go with chapter 11, there's a duality there with the king of the south and the king of the north. And you could, it's eschatological, that passage, of some sort of interplay with them. And various people in the history of the Christian church have seen that duality. And then that played out in their eschatology and views of the Antichrist. Now, we've looked at passages to which people have appealed for their concept of the Antichrist as many, or the Antichrist as duality. What about singularity? If you're only allowed one passage to argue for one single outstanding Antichrist, which one would you go for?
2 Thessalonians.
Yes, 2 Thessalonians 2. Beth is undoubtedly right. And the other passages all fit and work with this idea too. There are bits for the many and the dual that you can appeal to, but for the singular, you've got a clearly established 2 Thessalonians 2, and you've got the other passages which all work with it. So how do you put the numbers and the passages together? How do you relate the one and the many? Well, there's one verse that does it. Julian? 1 John 2, verse 18. As ye have heard that Antichrist, singular, shall come, future, even now, present, first century, and it's also the case in 2024, are there many Antichrists? So you have a singular Antichrist in the future, and many Antichrists, plural, in the first century, and the second century, to the third, and up to the 21st. It's very, very simple. What about relating the singularity and the duality? What about the singularity, one Antichrist, and two, with respect to Daniel 7 and 8, the two little horns? What do you do with the two little horns?
Ignore them.
You ignore them. Yeah, you could do that. Yeah. Well, there are two little horns, not because there are two future antichrists. There are two little horns because both of them refer to or typify the one antichrist. And there's certain things that can be learned from each of them. So Daniel 7's little horn, Rome, mentions different things in that context. Daniel 8's little horn, Greece. And then you could add then Daniel 11, which develops Daniel 8, tells us more. What about Revelation 13? And here, I'm not going to be as ironclad. Some people say that the second beast is not a second person. Right? So the second beast is just another aspect of the first beast. Okay, so that resolves the issue of duality. Others say that the second beast is a second person. But even then, Revelation 13 very, very strongly emphasized this time and time again, that he is subservient. And that if you take it as an individual, the second beast, the beast of the land, also called the false prophet, he isn't spoken of anywhere else in the Bible. He's not spoken of in the book of Daniel. He's not spoken of in 2 Thessalonians 2. There's no second subservient figure to the Antichrist in 1 John or 2 John. So if there is a second person, an eschatological person, a literal concrete individual who is the beast of the land, also known as the false prophet, he's mentioned in one passage and he's strictly subservient. So the two are at the one time, but one is doing the bidding and advancing the cause of the first and greater beast, who is, properly speaking, the Antichrist. The other one is an assistant, a very capable assistant, to be sure, but not the main man. We'll come now to conclusion. Some of you might be thinking we're finishing a little bit early. I hope you are. The Antichrist, then, is an individual, not an institution, not an impersonal movement or spirit, not an internal evil impulse, but the Antichrist does allure people individually. There is a spirit of Antichrist, and he uses institutions as their ruler. And the Antichrist is singular, so it's the last in both of those lists, an individual, and as to number, singular, even if Revelation 13 does mention a second concrete individual. It's the only passage in Scripture, and he is a chief lieutenant during his life. We've been laying foundations, as well as clearing away some rubble. Next week, and with this established, such is my plan currently, and this in God's will, of course, we're going to look at this singular individual, and he's not only single, but he is singular, this singular individual, and we're going to consider his nature. I'll explain that more next week. His parentage, and even gender and pronouns.